The slave army was committed to its crossing. 20 lines had been strung from the south bank to the midstream island, and now they were laying the lines from there to the north bank. The ford was congested with a great struggling mass of humanity. Clinging to the bark ropes, they were wading steadily across towards the island. Only their heads showed, long lines of black dots around which the water swirled and creamed. Already there were 15,000 or 20,000 slaves in the water, and the number increased steadily as the horde on the south side filed down the bank and took to the ropes. It was happening just the way that Hui had known it would. The party on the south bank would dwindle to a size which would be a fair match for Backmore's impatient warriors. Hui smiled as he imagined how Backmore must be chafing at this delay. He had longer to wait, Hui decided, as he watched the first slaves emerge from the green waters and scramble thankfully out onto the island, with their black skins shining wetly in the morning sunlight. Their thankfulness was premature, Hui thought. There was still the north channel of the river between them and safety. They began filing off the island, while behind them the bark ropes bowed downstream with the weight of human bodies, and the island itself swarmed with naked black flesh. It was an awesome spectacle, such a multitude strung across the river, and still a dense mass of black men upon the south bank. If it is Tyburn, he will know enough to hold his best men in the rearguard. Hui peered at the men waiting to take their turns upon the ropes, and it seemed that they were steadier and better armed than those in the van. He must let their number reduce further before he could risk Backmore's tiny force against them. Hui turned his attention back to the ford. From the island, the lines of heads were creeping slowly towards the far bank. He could see now that he would have a difficult choice to make. If he delayed his attack much longer, then many of the fugitives would escape into the dense forests of the north, beyond the reach of his arm forever. However, if he struck before they escaped, it would mean committing Backmore to battle with vastly superior numbers. The choice was a delicate one, and Hui pondered it carefully. His decision was made when he thought suddenly of the day in the future when he would report to his king. "Not one of them escaped, Majesty." And he could almost hear the reply, "I did not doubt it, my bird of the sun." Hui turned to the captain of the galley who stood beside him. "Hoist the standard," he said quietly. And immediately the order was shouted to the foredeck. The golden battle standard soared to the masthead. As a hoarse cheer rose from the rowing decks of the galley, Hui saw the battle signal repeated in the other galley anchored on his starboard beam. In the bows, a sailor swung a battle axe, severing the anchor cable, and the galleys spread their wide wing of oars. They dipped and swung and rose, wet and gleaming, golden and silver in the sunlight. Under Hui's feet, the ship dashed forward against the current so swiftly that he staggered before he caught his balance. The galleys flew in formation, their great wings beating, arrowing upstream on a diverging course that would carry each one through each channel of the river. "Steer for the center of their line," Hui ordered the galley captain, and the order was shouted to the helm. They raced down on the crowded ropes, strung like black pearls with the heads of struggling men. Above the rush of water and the creak and dip of oars, Hui heard a mounting hubbub of terror from the men who looked up at the deadly bows that towered above them. He moved to the bulwark and looked down. He saw their faces turned up towards him, and their eyes showed white in the dark faces. He crushed down the stirrings of his pity, for these were not men. They were the enemy. The archers in the bows were loosing their arrows into them now. Hugh saw an arrow strike one of them squarely in the face, and stand there as the man threw his arms high and was swept away by the current. The galley cut into the heavily laden ropes, slowing slightly and lurching as the weight of them checked the forward dash. Then they snapped and burst asunder beneath the iron-shod bows, and the current swept the lines of men away into deep water, washing them under the walls of the garrison, where Hui's archers waited to pick them like wind-fallen fruit. The galleys drove through the shallows, scraping their keels against the rock bottom of the ford, and then they were into the deep water beyond, and Hui ran to the stern and looked back. The river was filled from bank to bank with screaming, drowning men. Some of them clung to the branches of overhanging trees, others to slippery outcrops of rock, or to floating pieces of driftwood and mats of papyrus. The island was completely hidden by a solid blanket of wet and shivering humanity, and still others were trying to find a foothold upon it, floundering and struggling in the shallows. There were so many of them that they reminded Hui of a migration of insects rather than human beings. They were like ants, tens of thousands of ants. He held that thought as he steeled himself to give the next order. The galley captain was watching him expectantly. He could see the sailors in the bows at the tubes. They were looking up at the castle, waiting for the order. "Very well, Captain," Hugh said, remembering that there were ants and not men. Instantly, the galley captain was shouting his orders, and the ship swung broadside to the current. The other galley conformed to this manoeuvre, and from the bows of both of them, the deadly jets of Opet's secret weapon, Baal's fire, was squirted. It sprayed upon the surface of the river, spreading smoothly. The sunlight broke into rainbows of colour upon the floating liquid, and the stink of it was oily and rank. And then magically it burst into flame. The entire surface of the river became a solid sheet of roaring orange flame, from which banks of sooty black smoke billowed, and the heat of it was so intense that Hughie drew back quickly as he felt his beard singe. "In Baal's holy name," Hughie whispered as he watched the fire, named for the great god Baal, sweep majestically downstream, filling the great river from bank to bank, filling the sky with dark clouds. It flowed over the crowded island, and when it had passed, the blackened bodies lay in high, smouldering heaps, while the driftwood and dried papyrus burnt like a funeral pyre. The wall of fire marched downstream, past the fortress walls, searing the vegetation along each bank, sweeping the river clear of life. In short, in 10 minutes, 20,000 souls had perished, and their charred bodies floated down towards the sea, or washed up as flotsam along the sandbanks and back eddies of the river. After the flames passed, Timon stood appalled and stared at the devastation. He could not believe the dreadful destructive force he had just witnessed. He could not believe that more than half of his army had vanished so swiftly. He was left with a small portion of his original command. Those left were his best men, but in truth he knew them to be no match for the cohorts that opposed him. Although he realized that he must make his dispositions for the attack which would now surely follow, yet he wasted a few seconds staring longingly across the river to the north, where his own land lay. He was cut off from it now, perhaps forever. The galleys lay 100 paces off the bank with their bows pointed towards him. They were as menacing as 2 great reptilian monsters. And now he had seen them in action, Timon felt fear's chilly breath on his neck when he looked at them. Behind him rose the roar of challenge and counter-challenge, and the clash of shields and weapons. Timon swung about. The second attack had come, as he feared. It had come with the precision and timing he'd expected. It had come crashing into his rear at the exact moment when his men's stomachs were cold with the dreadful destruction they'd witnessed in the van. Timon felt his anger swell and buoy him upwards, and his hatred rose with it. Anger and hatred, the forces upon which his whole existence depended. Anger that he must fight against men like these with such fragile weapons. Even as he turned to join the conflict, he swore an oath that he'd sworn 100 times before. I will build an army from my own people, which will match these pale-skinned devils. Timon fought his way towards the rear through the press of his own men. The attack was driving them back steadily, jamming them against the river, packing them so densely that they could neither maneuver nor wield their weapons. It was a nightmare sensation attempting to find a way through this swaying, surging sea of black bodies. Desperately, Timon bellowed his orders, trying to force them forward, trying to make them deploy outwards. But his voice was lost in the battle roar, and even his great strength was helpless in this jam of black humanity. Over the heads of his men, he could see the enemy helmets and plumes ringing them. The sword and axe rose and fell to a solemn rhythm, and before them, his men dropped their weapons, turned their backs, and tried to burrow their way into the massed bodies of their companions. The pressure increased steadily, smothering the ranks behind and driving them steadily back towards the river. Over the heads of the attackers, the archers and javelin men hurled a rain of missiles into Timon's center. And so densely was it packed that the dead men couldn't fall but were held upright by their neighbors' striving bodies. Now the galleys stole in quietly towards the bank, and from the high castles the archers loosed their arrows into the van of Timon's army. The bank began to crumble away beneath the desperate feet, and living and dead slid and fell into the swift waters. Soon the colour of the water changed, from green to brown, and then to the bright scarlet of lifeblood. A river of blood, Holiness, the galley commander remarked in conversational tones. I've heard it sung by the poets before, but this is the first time I've ever seen it. Huey nodded without answering. He could see that the battle had reached a point of equilibrium. The pressure that Backmore's cohorts, even strengthened with those of Mago, could exert, was insufficient to drive the enemy back another yard. Soon that pressure must relax, for already the axemen were tiring. When that happened, the slave army would explode outwards like a released bowstring. It needed but an ounce more pressure to topple the slaves into the river, but that pressure must come within the next few minutes. Huey muttered impatiently, Come, Backmore, are you blinded by blood? Has battle lust drowned your reason? Now is your moment, but it's passing. And Huey began to pace the wooden deck anxiously. It was so clear to him what should be done that it amazed him that others couldn't see it. Come, come, Backmore, come, he pleaded. And then he grunted his relief. Not a moment too soon. Backmore had charged his war elephants into the massed remnant of Timon's army. Trumpeting and squealing, the huge animals waded through living bodies, crushing them underfoot, lifting men in their trunks and flinging them towards the sky. A terrified screeching of despair went up from 10,000 throats, and Timon's army turned to water. Now! Shouted Huey. And the galleys shot in towards the banks of the river. They ran aground together, and from them poured 400 heavy axemen, led by Huey Ben Ammon. His men tried to keep with him, for in the 6th Legion the place of honour in battle was at the side of the high priest. But the vulture axe clave forward so swiftly that it took a good man to pace it. For Baal! And they reaped the bloody harvest, so the ground beneath their feet turned to red mud, and the river flowed brightly. In the midst of it, Hui saw Timon. The shock of it slowed his arm for a second, and a spear jabbed at him, scoring his ribs. Hui killed the spearman with a casual backhanded stroke, and then cut his way through the press towards Timon. It was slow work, and Timon retreated ahead of him, towards the river bank. "Timon!" Hui shouted in desperation. And those terrible, smoky yellow eyes turned to him and held his gaze. They were the eyes of a leopard in a trap, cruel and merciless. "A challenge!" Hui called. "Fight me!" In reply, Timon reared to his full height and hurled his spear at Hui. Hui ducked, and the point glanced off his helmet and bedded itself in the neck of the man beside Hui. The man cried out and fell. Timon turned, and with three strides he had reached the bank of the river. He leapt out into the red waters, and then struck out powerfully in the overarm stroke that Hui had taught him. Hui reached the edge of the bank, and tore off his helmet and breastplate, snapped the leather straps of his greaves, and kicked off his sandals. Naked, except for the belt which held his axe, Hui looked out across the river. Timon was out of range of the archers on the bank. He was halfway across to the island in the time which it had taken Hui to strip. Hui dived cleanly from the bank and struck the water flat on his belly, and then he was swimming, dragging himself through the bloody water with those long, thick arms and churning the surface white with his powerful legs. On the island, Timon had found weapons, the throwing spears of the charred bodies that lay thick upon the ground. As Hui found his footing and waded ashore, Timon hurled the first of them. Hui deflected the spear with a swing of his axe, catching the spear blade full on the great butterfly-shaped head, swatting the spear out of the air as though it were an insect. Again Timon threw, and again. But now Hui was charging him across the rocky, copse-strewn ground, and each thrown spear was caught neatly upon the head of the axe and sent spinning aside to fall harmlessly on the rocky earth. In desperation, Timon stooped and picked up one of the round river boulders as large as a man's head. He lifted it over his head with both hands and stepped forward as he threw it. The rock caught Hui a glancing blow on his shoulder and knocked him down on his back with the axe skidding away from his hand. Timon charged at him, careless in his anger and hatred. Hui bounced off the earth, flipping himself forward like a thrown javelin. The top of Hui's head crashed into Timon's body just below the ribcage, and the air of his lungs rushed out of his throat in a gasp of agony. Timon doubled up and dropped to his knees, clutching at his chest with both hands. Hui stood over him and bunched his hand in the manner of the gladiators. He struck Timon with the bony hammer of his fist, just below the ear, and Timon toppled forward senseless to the rocks. "I cannot kill you, Timon," Hugh's voice came to him through grey mist and from a great distance. "Though you deserve death as no one else has done before you, you have betrayed my trust. You have carried the sword against me and my king. You deserve to die." Hui's face came into focus, and Timon found himself lying on his back with arms outstretched. He tried to move and found himself bound. Leather thongs were knotted tightly about his fingers and pegged down to the earth, holding him captive. He rolled his head and found himself on the north side of the island, hidden from watchers on the south bank and alone with Hui. On the rocks beside him, a small fire of driftwood burnt. Hui had lit it from a smouldering remnant, and in it was heating a broad spearhead, with its shaft snapped off short. "There is little time," Hui explained reasonably. "Soon my men will come to find me, and then it will be out of my hands. I have made an oath to my gods, so I cannot give you the punishment which you've earned. And yet, I have a duty to my king and my people. I cannot let you carry the sword against us again." The Romans had an answer for this, and though I hate all things of Rome, I must use their methods now. Hugh stood up and leaned over Timon. "I made a mistake with you. No man can ever tame the wild leopard." Hui held the vulture axe in his right hand. "You were never Timon. You were always Manatasi. You are as different from me as the color of my skin is different from yours. There was never a bond between us. It was illusion. For though our mouths speak the same language, our ears hear the sounds differently. Your destiny is to seek the destruction of all that I hold dear, all that my people have built and tended. My destiny is to protect it with my very life's blood." Hui paused, and there was true regret in his heart as he went on. "I cannot kill you, but I must make sure that you never carry the sword again." The vulture axe sang, and Timon screamed once, and then whimpered softly, as his severed right hand twitched and trembled like a dying animal on the scorched earth of the island. Hui fetched the heated spear blade from the fire, and sealed off the pumping blood vessels of the stump in a hissing puff of stinking smoke. Then he cut the thongs that still bound Timon. "Go," he said. "You must trust yourself to the river now. My men will come to search the island soon." Timon dragged himself down the beach, and at the water's edge he looked back at Hui. His huge black body was scarred and ravaged, and his eyes were terrible. Slowly he lowered himself into the water, holding the raw stump of his arm across his chest. The current took him, and his head dwindled to a speck upon the wide river, until it was swept beyond the bend below the fort. Hui watched it out of sight. Then he stooped and picked up the severed hand from the ground and dropped it onto the fire and piled dry driftwood upon it.